episode of Freaky Trigger and Pollards of Lop, which is our podcast about the polls that are run on the @peoples_pop Twitter account, the People's Pop Polls. This month, we have been talking about the music of 1990. The poll is reaching its climax. We are heading into the quarterfinals in the coming week, but we won't necessarily be talking about the results and such like in this podcast. We will be discussing more generally the music of 1990. I'm Tom Ewing, and I am joined today by Maura Johnston.
Hi.
Sarah Clark.
Hello.
And Steve Mannion.
Hello.
Who are all, well, they were all alive in 1990, but at different stages of their life. So perhaps we could kind of introduce ourselves by explaining where we were and what we were doing in 1990 and what kind of a few sort of top musical memories of the year.
Sure, I'll start. So I'm Maura Johnston. I'm based in Boston, Massachusetts right now. But in 1990, I was in 9th and 10th grade, and I was living in Hicksville, Long Island, watching a lot of MTV, like so much. Lots of Headbangers Ball that I would VHS record every Saturday night because it aired from 12 to 3, and I would usually fall asleep before it was over. And I guess some of my most vivid memories of that time are buying the Band in the USA single by Two Live Crew, which we'll be talking about later. Going to concerts, including Poison and Warrant. And gosh, I don't even remember. Like, there were so many. Like, that was when I started really going to concerts in earnest at the Nassau Coliseum in Uniondale, New York, which is now shutting. And I also bought a lot of CDs from the CD store that was two doors down from the bakery where I worked. And they let me buy stuff in cash, and they didn't make me pay sales tax. I don't know if they'll get in trouble for that retroactively now. It was like 30 years ago, and, you know, I think the sales tax was pretty much... I mean, I bought a lot of CDs from them for sure, but I would get many used CDs for $8 a pop, which swelled my library, not to the point that it is now, but definitely it was a good start.
Cool. Is the CD store still there?
No. It closed. Well, it moved to a bigger store down Route 107, which is the road that it was on in Hicksville. It moved to a shopping center, and it renamed itself from NYCD to Purple Haze. And then it closed, and then the shopping center that it was in got razed. So now it's a Lowe's.
Sarah, where were you in 1990?
My story is slightly different from Maura's story in that I was going to my ice skating lessons. The TV in our house was pretty much never turned on, radio not turned on, probably never entered into a record shop in my entire life. Last year of primary school, yeah, going pretty good. I had pretty much felt up until that time that I didn't really know about music. Like, it wasn't my thing. It wasn't my place to know about. I hadn't really encountered it a lot. When I started getting into music, really, it was a couple of years later. So probably about 94, 95, 96. And so I really kind of had the idea then that, you know, this was year zero for me. So 1990 was kind of a prime year of never go back there. Like, this is not the stuff that you look into. And when I started looking back into music, I skipped a few years before. So I had a lot of interest in finding things from, say, 1987 and 1988. And then kind of had the idea that what happened in 1990 was kind of the end of whatever cool stuff was happening in 1988. So coming to the 1990 podcast was kind of really interesting and a bit of a fearful experience for me, because I was slightly terrified that I'd actually listened to Carter, the Unstoppable Sex Machine, and what if it was good? That would go against everything that I felt that I ever stood for.
Was it good?
Results to be revealed on that one later.
Okay. Steve, what were you doing in 1990?
I turned 12 that year, so my first year, what you could call high school, but we don't hear so much, I guess. And for me, it was kind of year zero as a consumer and collector of music. So I'd started to buy my own records, albeit with whatever pocket money I had, and often making the choice between that or magazines, or computer games, or magazines about computer games. So my musical memories at the time are very positive, and they're very sort of mixed across different media. Like, I was attracted to music that might sound like, oh, that sounds like a video game I was playing, or a good soundtrack for the comic book stories I was reading in 2000 AD at the time, say. So all these things just seemed to gel together quite well. And that might explain why I was going to HMV and buying like rave records, despite being far too young to appreciate the full context in which they were made.
Or
might be
raving.
Best heard, yeah, indeed, yeah. So a little too young for gigs and raves, but really interested in how that music sounded from quite an early age.
My 1990 story is I turned 17 in 1990. I was at school, I was at boarding school, and I was very into Cast the Unstoppable Sex Machine, among other things. But I was basically, I was very into indie, but I was also starting to once again understand that there might be a world beyond lads with guitars making a racket. And so that was the year I bought my first hip-hop album, which was Fear of a Black Planet. And I started buying and listening to kind of dance music that was coming on the radio. And I have a very vivid memory of one summer afternoon being taken to some family gathering that I didn't want to be at, and kind of making an excuse to go out and just sit in the car and listen to the radio. And they were playing Betty Boo and the KLF and a bunch of other things that were in the charts in 1990, and me thinking, wow, this is fantastic. This is much better than, you know, sitting in my bedroom listening to Morrissey or whatever, though I didn't stop listening to Morrissey for many other years after that. It wasn't like, you know, unfortunately, it wasn't some kind of amazing conversion away from that. So it was a good year to be kind of into that. I guess actually a question, what music did you think was bad at the time in 1990, and is it still bad?
This is probably a cliche, but I did not like a lot of the super dominant soft rock, so Michael Bolton. But I even liked like Hold On by Wilson Phillips.
That's an incredible song.
Yeah, I'm looking at the number ones. And, you know, the thing is, and I know we're going to talk about this in a bit, but like, I feel like because rock was so, like, I was so centered on rock, but I also had always loved like dance pop as a kid, because that was, you know, what the radio station in New York, Z100, played. So I even, you know, enjoyed like Opposites Attract by Paula Abdul and MC Scat Cat. I guess like I didn't really like the balladry of the time. So for example, like I really loved Stevie B's I Want to Be the One, but because I Love You, the Postman song was a little too sugary. But now I was wrong.
You've come around to Because I Love You.
Yes. Oh my gosh, yes. It was used to great effect in this really amazing movie called The Guest. Super, super good movie. And there's a great scene with it. Totally recommend.
Has anyone else had any kind of like, you know, revelations that the stuff that they thought was terrible in 1990, in fact, bangs?
I feel that you might be fishing to get a certain result out of me here.
No, I would entirely understand if that result was not forthcoming.
I do have to say that the Carter track that I listened to, called Happy, was not as bad as I thought it would be, but I don't really feel any urge to listen to it again. I kind of had this feeling kind of in 1998 maybe, when I think a Defcon 1 by Pop Will Eat Itself was on a compilation, and I kind of liked it. It was incredibly dumb, didn't know what a DEFCON was, never mind what number one was, and what that has to do with McDonald's, or, you know, any other burger chain of your choice. I had no idea, but it was kind of all right, so I made sure never to listen to any other Pop Will Eat Itself after that, till I listened to Dance of the Mad Bastards from The Pole.
Which has done shockingly well in the poll, thanks to the attention of the official PWEI Twitter account.
Well done on you, Dance of the Mad Influencers.
I think one of the great things about the poll is seeing if any factions turn up for a particular act. Knowing what's possible now, what the power of these organised groups can achieve.
No one has nominated for next month's debut singles poll. No one nominated the Pop Release Itself debut single, which is good because it is absolutely awful. I went and listened to it just in case they did.
See, I think I liked them at the time. Going back to the last question, I'm trying to think of a specific example, and I'm struggling because I think overall there's just a sense of, as you get further away from this time, and I've in recent years just tried to do things like create playlists of every hit, like every chart song year by year, and by doing that list literally listen to everything you could find on Spotify that charted that year, and end up feeling a bit more sentimental about the time that's passed, rather than I'm not going to start saying I really like that Michael Bolton song now, for example, or a lot of the things Moore has mentioned as, you know, big in the States at the time, like Stevie B or you know, Wilson Phillips, that were hits here too, not everything, but, you know, didn't maybe have quite the same impact. And I suppose at the time I was a bit wary of all. I mean, we still had we had new kids, obviously, of sides at Atlantic, and sort of Stockade, Corman and Waterman's lesser loved acts like Big Fun and Sonia, maybe. But now, you know, but now it's kind of like, you know, there's nothing for me to hate about that year. And even when I look back, I'm like, I think I was just too excited by the amount of stuff going on.
A couple of songs stick out to me from the time, from the ice disco that I used to attend after my ice skating lessons. And the ones from that were What Time Is Love? And I feel that, I feel that 808 State may have been played, but I don't know. And was The Power in the Pool?
Snap.
By Snap?
It was, yeah.
Is it still in?
No, it got knocked out in one of the extremely brutal pop groups, where I think it went out against Vogue.
Oh, wow.
Which then got knocked out in turn, so...
Did the ice disco play Ice Ice Babe, or was that too on the nose?
No, I don't think they ever did. Mm. It was definitely the stuff that I thought of as like dance or rave at the time.
Gotcha.
I think one of my nominations would make good ice skating music, which was Thunder by Renegade Soundwave. Mainly because I have to remember the name of the sample, but it's that kind of string, very ethereal sounding string as you glide across the ice.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's quite a hard
aggressive track, but that bit's got, it's a nice balance there that I like. And you hear that in maybe Olympic by 808 State as well, you know, this idea that music for skating, Brian Eno, music for ice skating.
Yeah, I never went to a warehouse rave in my day, but I imagine the ice disco was a bit like it.
I didn't go ice skating until a few years later, and it did not go well.
Looking back at the concerts that were at the Nassau Veterans Memorial Coliseum.
Branded on your memory?
The ones that I went to, for sure. Because, they were big deals. Because that was, the first time that I ever sort of did that. Like, my first concert was in December of 1989, which was Motley Crue and Warrant.
That's an amazing first concert.
Yeah. And then I saw, Motley Crue. I saw Aerosmith and Skid Row in January of 1990. And Rush and Mr. Big. So I have seen Rush. Kiss with Slaughter and Little Caesar. And
this is so hard rocking.
I know.
Maura, is there a gig you most wish you had been to?
Oh, the Madonna show, for sure.
Yeah.
I wasn't allowed to, though. My mom was very anti-Madonna. And so, she was de facto banned from my house growing up because of her Catholic blasphemy.
What elements of Madonna's 1990 activities could have possibly...
I don't know. That was the Blonde Ambition tour, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So...
Was Sex that year?
Laid out.
Or was that the year after?
Sex?
It was a couple of years later.
I think one of the things I was interested in was like a pet sort of idea for me is that Madonna was so dominant seeming in 1990 as much as she had been, three or four years ago. But there's a nice variety to the single, between Dear Jesse and Justify My Love. Those are like two ends of, two extreme ends. And in between that, you've got Vogue and Hanky Panky.
Hanky Panky, yes, the elephant in the Madonna room.
Actually, that's the song I hated at the time.
I
was disappointed in. And I liked everything else.
Well, that was also part of the whole Dick Tracy.
Yeah, which I even went to see in the cinema.
You saw that in the movies?
Not because I was a huge Madonna fan. I think it was just like, oh, that looks like it might be good.
Well, it was like the big blockbuster of that summer, right?
It was, it was that year's Batman.
Yeah.
Or it was meant to be that year's Batman. But
She was all powerful. More than anyone else. I mean, Janet Jackson didn't seem to have the same impact in the, so at least not in the UK charts. But I remember at the time reading about another Janet Jackson song at number one in the US, you know. And this is the, just, I mean, obviously it's the year Mariah Carey, you know, really started, and she went on to have a similar dominance. But I wasn't so much like that here. I think in 19, what makes maybe 1990 stand out is there isn't somebody who's, I might be completely wrong here, but we were just over the Jive Bunny, sort of three number ones in a row, sort of thing. And no one else was really having that kind of number one after, no, multiple number ones. There weren't actually that many that year. Obviously, we've covered it in Tom's popular series and FT. Maybe that's, I don't know, there's a good aspect to that, which is that it makes 1990 seem like a really wide open marketplace.
But speaking of Madonna, I'm really curious as to why do you think that Madonna is not doing particularly well in the polls?
She's not necessarily doing as well as you would, given that she's Madonna.
Right, and at the moment, people are paying lots of attention to like the Vogue era with like the popularity of like Pose and Drag Race, and yet they seem to go out of the polls quite quickly. Do you think this might be just Madonna or something else?
I think it might be a combination of her the demographic or the fan base, isn't there? Like, you know, you might get a surge for Pop Will Eat Itself or The Cure that you won't get for Madonna.
Yeah.
And the reasons behind that maybe are interesting. But also maybe with Vogue, I still love the track, you know, I always did like it. But there's a question of cultural appropriation discussion, you know, to be had about that has been had since it came out, and perhaps now is a bit more understood by a wider group of people.
I mean, so. I'm not sure a lot of the people voting in the polls have read.
I agree.
I think it might be a combination of like almost taking her for granted, and there's definitely like, you know, it seems like the voting has shaken out to, there's a very particular idea of dance music, and Madonna is, it just doesn't fall into what has been winning. A lot of things that have been knocked out, I've been kind of shocked by.
I mean, I think there's probably also a sense that like, you're thinking about 1990 and you want to be kind of rewarding the tracks that kind of flared up in 1990. And there's a sense that, well, there'll always be another year where we can vote for Madonna.
Right.
There'll always be another time when, whereas like it went out, the thing that actually knocked it out was Killer, the Adamski record. Obviously, it's an excellent record. You're only ever going to vote for an Adamski record. Get the chance really to do it here and now. So, you know, whereas if we do, say, I don't know what year we're doing next, but if we do 1985 next, there'll clearly be an embarrassment of Madonna tracks that we could also be talking about, which will probably then go out early on the same grounds, because it's like, oh, well, when else can we vote for Red Box?
It's almost like her longevity, and I think this is true for Janet too. It's like her longevity is like a disadvantage.
It's unfair, I guess, because she had such an idiosyncratic year as well. So she was a very interesting, she's always an interesting figure. She was a very interesting figure in 1990. She was doing sort of a particular variety of things.
Well, yeah, because like she had, you know, the tour, which was making headlines. And one of the things that I wanted to talk about was the way in which, in the States at least, discussion about pop music was very dominated by the sort of aftershocks of the Parents Music Resource Coalition, PMRC, which was the organization of like moms and housewives, and air quotes, that pushed for the parental advisory stickers on records. So like this was before SoundScan debuted. So the charts were still a little fungible because like they were not calculated by direct measurement of sales. Instead, they were calculated by clerks and people at record chains calling in and saying like, hey, like these are our top records of the week. And then that was how, you know, the charts were deduced. But one thing that was happening was that hip hop especially was getting sort of under fire, hip hop and metal, which metal songs had been on what was called the Filthy Teen, was the list of songs in 1985 that was the PMRC's piece of evidence that pop music was in a place that was just completely beyond not repair, but beyond decency, I guess.
Degenerates,
exactly. Yeah, yeah. And so, like, it had, like, In My House by the Mary Jane Girls and, like, Fuck Like a Beast by Wasp, Darling Nikki, and then, like, the Madonna song was Dress You Up, which I think they were just like, we have to have a Madonna song on there. Well, this is her most recent single, so okay. But one thing in 1990 was that this was the sort of, in the run-up to Justify My Love, this was the sort of watershed year in a lot of artists really, like, chafing against these new regulations. You had, you know, Jane's Addiction released their second album on Warner, Ritual de l'Habitual, and, like, the original cover was this sort of very stained glass window looking depiction of a threesome, and certain retail chains would not stock it. So instead they had a black and white cover with the text of the First Amendment on it as a, you know, for those chains that wanted the alternate version.
Yeah.
And then you had a lot of artists warrant suicidal tendencies, Sonic Youth, even like PDQ Bach, making reference to the PMRC and Tipper Gore specifically, because she was sort of at the forefront of it on their records, whether it was like Warren had at the end of their album Cherry Pie, they had Ode to Tipper Gore, which was sort of a cut up of just Janie Lane saying swear words in concert a lot. And then like the liner notes on Goo had like a little like Smash the PMRC cartoon in them. And then you had the sort of biggest, I think the biggest gesture, which was Banned in the USA, which was the Two Live Crew single. I don't know if it made it over there. Did it?
Yeah.
No,
this was recorded in one of my collections of NMEs from 1990,
okay,
where I think they did release it, but it's called like Clean in the USA or
something like interesting.
That,
okay,
lyrics amended.
Yeah, and then their record got ruled illegal to sell, and it was this whole like freedom of speech case. And so in the summer of 1990, and I remember the day that I bought this on Kasingle, they released Banned in the USA, which sampled Born in the USA. And Bruce Springsteen gave them permission, and it was like it only, you know, made the top 20 on the Hot 100, but it was sort of a big deal as a statement against what they saw as censorship that was brought on by not the government proper, but like people government adjacent.
I was wrong about Two Live Crew. It was As Nasty As We Wanna Be, which was changed As Clean As We Wanna Be.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. I think that was
so
the
clean
case
and so fresh.
I think that was the case in America.
Yeah, we had some minor controversies here with, sometimes it would just be something that had been seen on Top of the Pops or even the chart show airing a video. Like, I think I remember an Iron Maiden single from 1990, the video being deemed to be more sexist than you might expect.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, we were aware of this censorship debate in the States, but it wasn't really, you know, manifesting here so much. I mean, I think there was an issue with, like, I remember a story on The Word about Justify My Love actually being playing backwards and hearing satanic messages, and you know, the idea that it was like, this spooked me out quite a lot actually. Not that I tried it myself, but I was like, oh yeah, that's really, just hearing that, yeah, a record like that being played backwards, very sinister sounding.
Yeah. Judas Priest won their suit against their record being played backwards.
Yeah
that year.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it was around the same time, wasn't it?
I think I mean, we had the moral panic around House and Acid House and stuff, and that was still kind of going on. And obviously the idea that there was illegal raves and stuff. So it was much more, it was more of a drug panic than a kind of, than a kind of the content of the music, which is mostly pretty innocuous. I mean, except for the fact that loads of it is about drugs. There certainly isn't any sort of, you know, tirades of swearing. Of course, the other thing that was happening this year is that the language of hip hop was shifting. And becoming a lot more confrontational, and the NME had massive, it just did not know how to cope with stuff like NWA and the wave of gangster rap. It had sort of taken a position on what was great about hip hop. Its position was pretty much that hip hop was like, you know, Public Enemy were like punk, or they were like the Clash, and so it then became very difficult to fit these more radical in some ways groups into that framework. There wasn't the sort of the quite rockist analysis frameworks that they had kind of broke down. So, and I think that's one of the reasons they kind of stopped, you know, covering it as much over here. It certainly seemed to kind of like, there was a sort of like backing away.
Yeah, like maybe Public Enemy are the only one worth caring about, sort of thing. Or I think it was their album of the year, Fear for Black
Planet. I think the Mondays were the Enemy's album of the year. But Fear of Black Planet was up there.
Yeah.
The next actual kind of moral panic that kind of, you know, Pop has gone wrong and is leading the kids astray thing was 92 when Snoop Dogg came over for his first tour, and there was the tabloid headline, "Kick this evil bastard out."
Wow.
So that's kind of when we caught up. And then actually, like, the Mannix have a song where they talk about Tip of Gore, like, 3 or 4 years late. They suddenly throw in this Tip of Gore reference. So it's almost as if there was this kind of lag when all this stuff came through.
Yeah, it's odd.
And became a live issue.
It's odd, look, for me, looking back, when you actually look at the diversity within hip-hop at the time and the success of, you know, A Tribe Called Quest, De La Soul, as just as successful as PE and NWA, you know. I've always seen them as three, like a triangle of the sound at the time. Maybe you've got East Coast, you know, more sort of peaceful.
But then we had
West Coast gangsters, yeah.
But then we had the big white interloper at the end of the year.
Exactly. So there's a real style struggle going on. Yeah. But it seems like everyone's getting a slice of the cake at the time, at least in terms of you might not see. I mean, the Public Enemy were actually getting in the charts, and even NWA were with, you know, edited versions, perhaps.
In terms of what's in the NME in my samplers, it's definitely a Daisy Age rap or Daisy Age hip hop, which is getting the column in.
It knew where it was with Daisy Age hip hop. I think that there was, first of all, they often kind of, like, you know, A Tribe Called Quest sampled the Velvet Underground, not Velvet Underground, sampled Lou Reed. So immediately you're kind of like, okay, good, we know where we are here. If you're the rock press, so it's kind of that's fine. And like De La Soul also sampled rock music and things. So, I mean, like, credit where it's due. I was 17, and the NME's coverage of Daisy Age hip hop completely, you know, I would never have probably got into hip hop as a, you know, even to the limited extent that I did, were it not for very, very positive reviews of people like the Jungle Brothers, De La Soul, Public Enemy, who they loved before that.
Do you remember hearing is it What's It All About by Run DMC sampling Fool's Gold? And just I was like, how did they do this so quickly? You know, it's like a few months later and it's like already being reproduced in that way.
No, I do remember MC Tunes, who had a quite a strong run in the poll. He sampled I Am the Resurrection. So that was the Roses sampling hip hop record that I am.
Which I hadn't realised at the time, because I hadn't heard the album, and you know, only heard. The odd thing about the Stone Roses at the time, they had a long kind of, I guess the album single, the EPs there, kept re-entering the charts, and when the Charto would do their indie chart, it's half of it is Stone Roses still. You know, halfway through 1990.
On the topic of the Stone Roses, of course, they did put a single out in 1990, which has mostly been completely forgotten because it wasn't very good, which was One Love. And that, at the time, was a massive event, a massive kind of level of anticipation. It was one of the first singles that I kind of, you know, went out on release day specifically to buy, brought it back, thought, this is, you know, me and two of my friends also bought it, and we all came home with copies of it. And then we put it on, and then we were just like, oh no, they've blown it. And it was like the whole thing kind of deflated. And then it only got to number 3 or something. Mm. And it was going to be the first, like, indie number 1 and would have kickstarted the whole Britpop thing a few years earlier, I guess, or whatever. But it just felt like the kind of energy, you know, was suddenly sort of draining out of the whole scene because the Roses had fucked it. and yeah. Anyway, no one nominated One Love for the poll. Not me.
But I almost wish I had, having it. I'd never.
It might have done pretty well. Well, I mean, who knows? Maybe
it's not in my top. You know, it's not in my favourite year. But I never thought it was. Maybe if I'd been a bit older, I would have felt similar. But I remember the time thinking, "Yeah, this is okay." It's, you know, I didn't really like the Stone Roses that much at the time, and maybe they were like, I, you know, took a few to appreciate more.
I mean, there's no disappointment like 17-year-old indie boy, at the perceived false moves of your heroes. But to go back, because one of the interesting things, I guess, about the PMRC is that they completely lost,
right?
Like, that side in that particular culture war absolutely lost, and, you know, pop music is now just gleefully obscene all the time.
Well, I think that a big part, a big thing that contributed to the loss came in 1991 when SoundScan launched, because SoundScan really changed the way that record sales were perceived, you know. And it was, I think, the first week of SoundScan, number 1 and number 2 were NWA and Skid Row, and like that was just a complete change from what record store clerks and record store buyers had been reporting as selling well. And I feel like one of the things about the shift away now is just that we're almost at like the opposite end of the sound of the SoundScan sea change, right? In that like digital track stream, you can see in real time what people are streaming, and you can see that they're like really gravitating toward like the hard edged, the, you know, I don't want to sound like a scold. It's just like, you know, it's very sort of like grimy and salacious and stuff.
Yeah.
And then some of the songs are good, you know, some of them are good. Some of them are just Drake, but some of them are good. And, and like, it is funny though, because I feel like on the singles chart for such a long time, radio programmers were a mediating influence against the sort of id of the market. And that's just gone away in a really big way. Because now radio is really looking to like Shazam and streams to help make its programming decisions. And obviously those decisions in the States are becoming even more and more concentrated with the increased concentration of ownership. But we're talking about a time when that wasn't the case, which is great. Because, man, the top 100 songs of 1990 is so much more interesting than I even remembered. It has, well, there are 5 Janet Jacksons, which is great. And then there's, you know, like in terms of hip hop, right? You have The Humpty Dance and you have Get Up by Technotronic, which is, you know, I think hip adjacent. And then you have.
It seemed like a good time to be a woman in rap. I think, you know, arguably better than now. That's one of my feelings too, that not just in rap, but, you know, there were a lot of women MCs at the time.
I would say yes and no, because I feel like hip hop was pretty marginalized then still.
Sure.
So, like, you were maybe in a better place in the genre, but you were still sort of in a marginalized place in the wider world.
Yeah.
But also, you know, 1990 was great for, like, freestyle and New Jack Swing. And, you know, you had Rub You the Right Way. You had 2 songs in the top 11 of the U.S. Hot 100 that were by Bell Biv DeVoe, the post-New Edition New Jack Swing band.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I listened to every song nominated in the playlist, and it reminded me, oh, I should have listened to more Tony.
Yeah.
A couple of bands of that ilk or acts of that ilk who just sort of parted by a bit. You know, they didn't, again, they just didn't, if they'd had a big enough hit, perhaps, you know, I might have got around to it. Yeah, there's a few like that.
Yeah.
And some of them might even have been nominated more freestyle type stuff, I think, seemed to get one of the more positive reactions of, I had never heard of this, but it's great. You know? So that was, in terms of discoveries in the poll, it's tricky, but there are a few things that stood out for me, although I'm struggling to remember their name, were a couple of those tracks.
Yeah.
As well as Berlin Wall by Coco T.
Yeah, like...
Which was accused of being a CIA plot.
well, there you go.
By a commenter.
The censorship, you know, debate, the rage continued.
Well, that's funny, too, yeah. Given... I didn't even think of that aspect of the CIA accusations. Yeah. It's interesting because hard rock was such a lightning rod genre, you know, as far as being looked down on by the establishment, and yet the allegation that Wind of Change by the Scorpions was this way to smuggle democracy past the Iron Curtain through whistling and power balladry is...
it worked, clearly.
Yeah, sure. Okay, yeah. But that's the thing, too. It was like a lot of, like, there were a lot of power ballads and songs of that ilk that were hitting big. You know, I mean, I think one thing about 1990 that isn't talked about a lot is just like how soft rock kind of made its big return on a lot of fronts, from like Michael Bolton to Celine Dion's first English language album to obviously Mariah Carey and, you know, even like the sort of quieter Whitney Houston songs, and then just all the power ballads. You had like Love and Affection by Nelson, I'll Never Let You Go by Steelheart, which like the highest, like that's a power ballad for the ages with a really, really high voice. And it was funny because I feel like it was part of how rock was becoming defined. You know, there was obviously in the States on MTV, we had 120 Minutes, which was the show for like the Smiths and the Cure. But then you had Headbanger's Ball, and Headbanger's Ball became this sort of like catch-all for anything that used like slightly loud guitars, right? So you had, you know, obviously you had like your Motley Crue's and your Poison's and your Warrants, but then you also had like Soundgarden, who were doing a totally different thing than Poison with their a lot more sort of angular and weird. You had Alice in Chains' first record, which was definitely like the early signs of grunge taking over. You had we called them the London Choir Boys, but in the UK they were just the Choir Boys, and they were very sort of like Faces style pub rock.
I was wondering if the Chili Peppers qualified for Headbangers
Ball.
Yeah,
no, they did. They definitely were on Headbangers Ball. I saw them.
Yeah.
You know, Faith No More too, right? And Faith No More toured with Soundgarden and with this band called Voivod, which was this like Canadian prog metal band. You know, it was just and everything was really not everything, but a lot of rock was really shoehorned into the hard rock ideal, for better or worse. It certainly was good for me because I learned a lot about bands that I probably would not have heard of. Like, I mean, Jane's Addiction alone, you know, I knew who they were because they had been nominated for a Grammy for Nothing Shocking. But when I first heard the song Stop, it's revelatory.
Hmm.
I have a lot of memories of like summer and like being at home and having like MTV on and just, you know, these songs that would play on the daytime programming of MTV, or my VHS tapes of Headbangers Ball that I would watch on the day, were really just loud and but hooky, and they sounded great. And they sounded, and I, you know, I didn't get a lot of the lyrical references to drugs. Certainly Love Hate's record, when I learned about the various names for marijuana, I was like, oh, that's what that meant about a lot of things on that album, which is a great album. You know, there was this sort of open possibility because everything was being sort of like shoved into one place, and so it was all kind of just like elbowing against each other. And the number of great rock records that I have from 1990 that I found out through my, you know, sort of early high school enjoyment of hard rock it's kind of staggering to just like look at it all at once.
But I think that's been one of the kind of themes that it was a transitional year in a lot of genres. It was a year where there was an awful lot of different things going on, a lot of different directions that were kind of happening. Because in, you know, in UK indie, which has been quite a dominant force in the poll, as well as the baggy stuff, which is what I kind of remembered more from it. You also have the first kind of shoegazing records coming out. The first releases by people like Ride, people like Lush having like their first sort of successful hit, and a load of kind of sort of scratchy stuff scrabbling around. And Sarah, you've been reading the NME, or you've dipped into the NME from 1990. What were your impressions of that?
Yeah, definitely. I think there's, I don't know, it's kind of strange because there's some of the articles, say for example about My Bloody Valentine, seem to be like, yeah, this is great, this is the year that they're really going to make it big. They've got an Andy Weatherall remix, which is going to do really well, except they don't like it, but don't worry, the kids, we think that you like it. It's a really kind of strangely written article. And then on the kind of baggy side, it's just full out, like, tribalism and localism, like the "are you from Manchester, are you from London" is just repeated in every single article. And I don't know if this is the case or how it was reading at the time, but we have a Flowered Up on the cover of one of the NMEs from July, I think. And
yeah.
I believe either they didn't have a single out at this time, and so the article about them reads like an article almost about menswear from 1996, in that who are these hyped up London boys,
yeah,
and why is one of them dressed as a flower? But they're going to be really big. But the Stone Roses didn't sing very well. Oh, you're only just realizing that.
I think there was definitely some real doubt as to whether bands outside Manchester could you know, master the astonishing musical alchemy of a funky drummer sample and some house piano, and then kind of droning on over the top of it that had created Baggy. So yeah, it was really territorial. I mean, I felt like a real kind of bandwagon jumper, being very into this stuff, but like living, obviously living in the home counties near London.
Did you take a side? Did you take the side of Flowered Up against
I felt Flowered Up were inauthentic compared to the likes of the likes of the Happy Monday. But at the same time, some of the stuff that was coming out of actual Manchester wasn't living up to expectations. So
yeah,
the Stone Roses were quite disappointing. I never liked the Charlatans that much anyway. And
like, bands from anywhere which aren't London or Manchester have seemed like they have to spend about half of the articles going, well, we're not from Manchester,
but that's a really good point.
Yeah, there's one with the Boo Radleys where they're just kind of going, can we just talk about something else?
Yeah.
To which the answer is no, you must talk about Liverpool. This is not very interesting. Yeah. Then again, it's better than the articles which are using a term regarding, I believe it might have been a pharmaceutical popular at the time, and calling it equity culture.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I hadn't heard about the... Yes. About equity before now, but I am flowered up really like equity.
That may have been an attempt to get past the censors.
No, it wasn't.
At IPC.
It wasn't. They use the term ecstasy quite a lot.
Because the enemy, when Acid House hit, the British music press, they kind of like were really into it, but then were also aware that most of their readers weren't actually that into it. So I think that's why kind of baggy and indie dance and stuff was such an absolute godsend for them, because it was a way that they could, you know, write about clubbing and dance music and this very exciting stuff that was happening in the fields of Britain. But also give it some kind of recognisable figures to hang on. It was such a geographically driven moment. Probably in the way that Seattle would be in 91 in the US or 91,
92. I was wondering if in the magazines like Enemy at the time, if there's an inkling of what's around the corner, or were they a bit caught out by that, we thought Stone Roses or MBV would be bigger, but fast forward a year, now we're really excited about Nirvana. And
yeah, I'm kind of, nobody's talking about, you know, Nirvana, like the grunge term, but there's an idea of, I don't know, we feel that something must be coming soon. So it feels like, okay, how long are we going to get away with this shuffling for? Like, okay, we like it when the Happy Mondays do it. They've been doing it for a while now. It's getting towards the end of 1990. And, you know, we're having to write about the mission still. Like, things could do with a change. But at that point, I don't think the change is being defined.
Are there any mentions of Sonic Youth?
Sonic Youth. There's no feature articles in particular about them. Yeah. I feel that they might have got a mention, but no more than a passing mention.
They were covered, and the other thing is that the British music press, because there was like more of it, there's now like none of it. But at the time, there was obviously a great deal of variety, and different publications had their patches. And the NME tended to keep the American stuff at a sort of arm's length, partly just it didn't have the access. It didn't, you know, its journalists didn't know the publicists and the bands and things in the way that, say, journalists at Melody Maker did. So you would get Sonic Youth covered more in those sort of things, and the NME was very much more, no, baggy is where it's at. You know, this is what's
there,
happening.
Gotcha. There is a Faith No More On The Road article, which I think might be one of the biggest ones, where they've featured a US artist on the road, and it's very much a we're on the road, here's how tour is hell sort of thing.
Yeah, I mean, I would imagine that there were probably perks that a music journalist in 1990 would feel that they would get from doing an on the road feature with Faith No More. That they would feel less sure about.
They also go to California with the Beautiful South.
yeah, I'm not sure they'd have got many perks going to California with the Beautiful South.
Oh, they didn't. It sounded awful.
I mean, one of the things, of course, that when you've got a very press-driven scene, which, because Morris talked about how in the US it was a very much a kind of MTV.
Yeah.
You know, the MTV was driving the culture in a way that I guess the music press wasn't as much. Whereas over here, alternative culture was still very much a product. Like, there was John Peel in the evenings on Radio 1, but there certainly you would barely get anything on TV. So it was, and in that kind of context, it becomes much more about kind of, you know, who gives good interview and who the journalists can get access to and who can be relied upon to turn up and do go-kart racing or whatever. Yeah. At the drop of a hat. And Paul Heaton of the Beautiful South seemed never to be out of the music press, given that he is a man who enjoyed the inside of a pub and liked mouthing off about stuff. And so you would get massive features on the beautiful South very regularly, probably because it was extremely easy to get hold of him when you had some space to fill.
That's really interesting because, you know, for me kind of coming in to music later doors, the beautiful South in my head might as well have been Michael Bolton, because they were on the same stations at the same time, you know, not particularly paying attention to their very subversive, of course, lyrics at the time to Rotterdam or whatever, then picking up these 1990 enemies and seeing the beautiful South on the cover.
It ties in a bit with what 1990 is not remembered for, which is that, you know, bands like that were really popular for a while, and they had the hits to prove that.
They had a number one and stuff, and I guess like the House Martins had been an NME band, and so there was a sense that kind of Paul Heaton was still sort of one of us. But I really think that it was mostly to do with the fact that he gave good quotes and he liked a beer, and made himself very available in a way that. And, you know, no one else in that kind of rock pantheon or even the sort of emergent rock pantheon would. You couldn't just kind of like call up Larry Mullen and get him to go down the boozer and review the singles.
There was a time where you could, and I'm trying to think if anyone actually achieved this or not, whether it was live or pre-recorded, but appear on The Word on a Friday night and then be on the Saturday morning kind of kids TV show, you know, which they bands on there, or at least they'd get exposure through panel reviews of pop singles. So I remember, Boy George would be in there, and they'd be like talking about the new NXS single. But then you might have a beautiful stuff. Might be an example. Yeah, someone who's able to appear on every possible outlet for music at the time. You know, not just off the top of the pops, but
which was much more a thing back in the 80s, I guess. In the kind of early 80s, that was the norm.
Jules Holland was it? It might have been 91.
I think it may even started in 90 or 91.
Speaking of Jules Holland, I realise we haven't addressed an act which I was going to make sure to ask Maura about. They are an act that did appear on Jules Holland, 1991, I think. And the act is Jellyfish. I'm very curious.
Oh my gosh.
Please. Yay. Please tell this disciple all about this band who got so many nominations in the poll that they had to be cut off.
Oh my, really? I didn't realize that. Oh wow. Well, they were a band out of California, and it was Jason Faulkner, Roger Manning, Andy Sturmer, and the drummer always shifted, but like those were the three main guys. They made really, really great power pop. Like they were just super into ELO and Wings and, you know, all of that kind of like really, really hooky stuff, but they kind of maximalized it in a lot of ways. They made it really spectacular and bright. The first single, The King Is Half Undressed, even without the video, which I'll talk about in a second, but it was just this very kind of like super sunshiny guitars, and there was a vocal break with just gorgeous ahs and in harmony. And then the video was this, you know, they were all dressed in like very kind of like hippie Fantasia, the Ren Faire guys get dressed up kind of clothing, which actually I think was kind of common for bands that were sort of like power pop leaning, certainly like Enough's Enough was similarly styled, I guess, when they were starting out. Enough's Enough being a band that was definitely more firmly slotted in the hard rock end of thing, in part because of their guitarist Derek Frigo, who was like a really just virtuosic guitarist. And they also had sort of like harder edged riffs and stuff. But Jellyfish was very like, every song on their first album, Belly Button, is incredible in its own way. You have obviously King Is Half Undressed with its gorgeous harmonies and very sort of like hyperactive feel. You have Babies Coming Back, which is very sort of like cute, really sad ballads like She Still Loves Him, All I Want Is Everything, is this completely just maximalist, you know, in line with the idea of the lyric. Lots of different sounds that are layered throughout. They're just so interesting and good. And it's so funny how like their look, so many people, I remember like my a friend of mine in high school was so turned off by them because of the way that they looked in the video. And I was like, but it doesn't matter. And she also objected because they were kind of dressed up similarly to Faster Pussycat in their video for You're So Vain. That song is one of the best singles of 1990. I'm I totally
you went there.
Think that that is the case. but I went there. That's one of my controversial statements for this podcast. But no, they were. I mean, like the thing is, you know, their look made them an MTV band, and they play like they even played like MTV Spring Break. Which do you all know about MTV's Spring Break? I believe they played it in 1991, but like the Spring Break thing was definitely still going on then. It was when during like Spring Break that you know American colleges have MTV would take its entire production down to whatever, I think it was Daytona Beach, and they would just have giant parties for all the people partying on the beach, and they would have bands play and everything, and Jellyfish played that. And yeah, I think you know they were like the sort of band that like. Music critics really liked them and like programmers really liked them, but like their commercial fortunes were definitely not as successful. Like Belly Button peaked at 124 on the album charts.
Oh, really?
Although I guess McFly's cover of Baby's Coming Back, I don't know, Tom, if you've written about this yet.
Not yet. No, Maura, of course I'll tell you when I write about Jellyfish.
Yeah, of course. Okay. But that was a number one in 2007. So, yeah. And they lasted for two albums and then they broke up. And like Roger Manning plays with and Jason Faulkner play with Beck, and like Roger Manning does a lot of his own stuff. Andy Sturmer worked with Puffy AmiYumi, the J-pop outfit, and like does a lot of music for cartoons.
People should probably go and listen to some Puffy AmiYumi, maybe the first single reason.
Yeah, they will get the chance in the next poll, I believe.
My adoration for this band is so overwhelming still, like 30 years after I first heard them, which I kind of love, because there are still new things to discover in both of their albums, and it's really impressive. And also they're super catchy and sad,
and they don't have this they're not turning up in retrospective polls or rankings, are they? I haven't, because I was aware of them from the time. They did have the first thing was a very minor hit, but you would only know about them through maybe the chart show, which actually did play you the video and tell you some interesting factoids about the band with any video they showed. But the opportunities for a band of that to appear in British TV were probably smaller than we might realize.
There was definitely bafflement, that so many of their songs had been nominated in the poll, that they'd hit the 3-song limit that we imposed.
And that was on a 10-song album too.
Yeah. they got a slightly rough ride in the poll. They did, the King Is Half Undressed did get through a couple of rounds. So that did well.
Thanks to my electioneering.
thanks to some hearty support from their number one fan. But I think that there is, like, one of the things that's been quite interesting is discomfort around some of the kind of quirkier entries in the poll, some of which are still in there. Like, They Might Be Giants, Birdhouse in Your Soul, which was a big hit in 1990. And though it didn't actually become a hit until 91, it was released in Australia in 1990, it qualifies. The Divinyls, I Touch Myself. And there's been various people saying, I'm baffled by these things doing well, they're novelty records, they're things... I found that really interesting as a sort of like what is it about these songs that are making people uncomfortable? In general, are people, because there were some people who were like, oh, I don't really like 1990. I don't think 1990 is a good year. And someone said, because, you know, I think that the stuff that happened before and after was just much stronger. And I think, I wonder if that, you know, in years where there's a big kind of settled thing that everyone now agrees on and that has kind of gone into history, and it isn't a year that's made up of all these kind of weird, quirky, little sort of detours and possibilities, that people like that more, or some people like that. So what's your take on why these quirky things kind of, both why they're popular and also what kind of puts people off them?
I'd started a thread about this a long time ago on a message board we all know and love, and I think I had Birdhouse in My Soul in my mind as an example of like, yeah, what happened to this kind of style of hit, if not necessarily the music. It's one of those things where it's like, oh, that was weird, you know, that was halfway between a song like that being out and where we are now. So, you know, mid-noughties kind of discussion of music and thoughts about 1990 then. And for me, I've always struggled a bit with, like, you know, my perception of time and this sense of, like, for me in the 90s is like a century, you know, because I was still pretty young when it started, so it took a long time to get from one end to the other. And then now, you know, it's obviously very different. So it all...
I mean, What you just said there, I think in some ways that kind of hit is sort of back now. Dance Monkey is an example.
Yeah,
and TikTok has brought them back. Something like Pow Fu's Deathbed, which has been a big hit this year, is exactly the kind of like thing that people are going to be really annoyed by when they remember it in 20 years.
The one thing
time.
I like about House in Your Soul is maybe it is because it's kind of chock full of references to things, and it's almost like a list. Then it becomes, oh, it's a bit like a list, you know. And there's a lot of list records in 1990 that we haven't really talked about, but just that approach to songwriting, maybe. Obviously, rap is full of it, and you might draw some in comparisons there, but I don't know. The talking about Jason and the Argonauts, for example, always sticks in the head, and maybe even stuff you didn't know at the time, like, oh, I wonder what he's talking about. Some person there, and this is like a year after We Didn't Start the Fire, Billy Joel as well. As different as these records obviously are, there's possible connection there, and the idea that whether that's went out of style and came back, or whether it's just a kind of lost, approach to creating a hit, creating something that can be a hit.
So my question about Birdhouse in Your Soul is, was that a commercial hit in 19?
It was,
top five, I think. It was a big novelty hit. Obviously, they had a huge career since, huge as in they have released a million, billion records. And I think there was probably some hope at the time. Was it Elektra? Elektra put out Birdhouse in Your Soul.
Elektra,
And it was big.
It was their first major label.
And Istanbul, Not Constantinople became a kind of like staple.
Of course, yes.
As well. And I think there was real hope that it would kind of, that this would be a long-running success story. And then they faded away and went back to being a cult band, which is probably what they were most comfortable in.
Is that because of 1990 being not necessarily a vacuum, but like you said about, people see it as there are bigger things before and after, like specific albums or scenes you can discuss at length, whereas, I don't know, I guess I think of 1999, what I like about it is, again, that it was a time where something like that could be a hit. I think at the first I didn't like it, and then it grew on me. So,
I mean, it's sort of weird because, like, obviously in Britain, you did have an awful lot of bandwagon chasing and people looking for just the next Stone Roses, the next
the Smiths,
that thing. But yeah,
it just is a case of it feels like these are the allocated ironic songs for this year. These are the songs that we'll all have a good laugh about, and they'll get played every week down the Inisco to give you a little jokey song in between getting down to some serious shuffling to the Happy Mondays.
I wasn't cool enough to go to actual discos in 1990, but I wonder what kind of things it would be good to talk to somebody who was an actual student at actual university to see sort of what would have been played, because one of my like mini theories about why the most successful hip-hop song in the poll has been Can I Kick It is that it's the most indie disco friendly
because of
all the hip-hop songs. That's my cynical view.
I really like the Divinyl song, but I've heard it a lot.
I think that album is great.
I've heard it a lot, though, and it doesn't either feel particularly 1990 to me. I think if you'd asked me before the poll when was that released, I would have said a couple of years earlier, in the same way that if you'd probably asked me when Hold On by En Vogue was released, I probably would have said quite a lot later.
I think here also we're speaking to, because I feel like there's a little bit of geographical disconnect well going on, because like this was definitely before worldwide releases of singles, like things were staggered, things were like, I was looking up I Touch Myself, because I think that that Divinyls album is like one of the best pop rock records of the early, and the album didn't come out until January of 91, and then I Touch Myself didn't really peak here until that spring.
I think same in the UK, actually.
I feel like with Birdhouse in Your Soul, that's an interesting case too, because like obviously like they might be giants, or like a they have like a huge following, and they had a huge following, but they weren't a pop act in the States. Like you didn't really hear Birdhouse in Your Soul on pop radio. You heard it on like WDRE or WLIR, like the modern rock stations, Kiss FM. K-Rock in LA, like those were the sorts of stations that you heard They Might Be Giants on. And they crossed over in that, like, just there was a big enough critical mass of people to really enjoy them. But I would say their most, you know, well-known song in the States is probably the theme to Malcolm in the Middle.
Right, yeah.
Which they did 10 years later, you know?
Yeah.
I know that there are going to be, they might be Giants fans listening who are going to be like, but what about, you know, blah, blah, blah. And it's like, no, I'm just speaking from like if you took people into a focus group at a mall and were like, what songs do you know? They would know probably the Malcolm. But I think also what they did was very canny in that, like, they retreat, you know, they used their major label money very, very wisely to embark on things like the Hello Records Club, which was, you know, the singles club that they sent CD singles to people who subscribed. They really kind of were ahead of the curve, you know, that you're seeing now of, like, super serving their big fans. Yeah. Also, I guess they relaunched Dial-A-Song. Do you know about Dial-A-Song?
I know about Dial-A-Song, but
I'm not sure I do.
I'll read it. I'll listen.
Where you would call, could call a number and They Might Be Giants would, on a regular schedule, have a new song at the end of the other line.
Wow. Amazing.
Yeah.
Before the internet.
But, well,
sort of.
Yeah, before the commercial internet. Not to front, but yeah.
No, that's it. They seem like the kind of band who would be innovative in that way, which, I appreciate. Yeah.
Sarah, as someone who was more new, obviously not new to 1919, that you were bopping out at the ice rink, but new to a lot of the songs in the poll, did it improve your opinion of the year, do you think? Kind of, you know, what are your overall impressions in the
It's kind of a I liked the songs that I knew, and I don't think there was anything new that I discovered that I particularly liked, apart from maybe Jungle Brothers, who I didn't really know anything about before, but I did really enjoy. I was quite surprised in that I assumed when Blur were going through that, oh yeah, obviously I'll like this. I'll definitely be voting for She's So High, but made sure to listen to it. And then about 15 seconds in, just thought, no. And I really just couldn't get on with it at all. And found myself, I think, voting for the Charlatans in that round of all things. So yeah. I think it came out there were some things that I thought I would like more that it turned out that I didn't like.
Yeah. There are a few things where you see that written down or in a poll situation and you think, oh yeah, I love that. And then when you actually listen to it, this isn't that great.
Yeah, one of my
Mr. Kirk's Nightmare was an example of my four here. It's like, this isn't...
It does go on quite a long time, Mr.
A lot depends on, yeah, whether you... Yeah, there's not necessarily a radio edit of a song like that. So that's definitely a factor.
Yeah, I was surprised by... I felt very defensive towards Unbelievable by EMF, and I don't really know why I would like that one out of all of those sorts of songs within the poll. But today, before the podcast, I did listen to Unbelievable a couple of times, and the shine is wearing off pretty quickly, I should say. However, Epsom Bad Funkers is a great name, and that's definitely what they're called.
That certainly is, yes.
So I think we had... go on, Tom.
I was just going to say, with the Blur, what you were talking about earlier, Steve, about how, like, there was this sense of, you know, the music press casting around for, like, okay, what's going to be next?
Mm.
You know, we've built them up, now we need to knock them down because the shine is wearing off. The first really big piece of press I can remember Blur getting was on the cover of, I think, Select, where it was Blur, We Killed Baggy. And this was around the time, not, it wasn't She's So High, it was one of the other singles off their first.
There's no
way. And so, yeah, there was this, like, very literally kind of, right, you've had your year, you know, like those cartoons that you get in American newspaper strips where you see the old year and it's got a kind of long beard and a tiny baby is kind of like, off you go. And that was how the music press worked. It was like, no, 1990s over.
Certainly there's an article in one of the enemies when She's So High is about to be released, and it's quite breathless. Steve Lamacq wrote it, I believe.
Think
he went to Colchester with Blur, and they bonded about how Colchester was rubbish. But seemed to be quite pro Blur at the time. So I guess that probably means in 6 weeks' time.
Were there any surprises? wise judgments in those issues of The Enemy? Any kind of classics that were getting a slating from the cream of the British music mind?
We have a, let me a look at some of the exciting notes. Well, apart from Stephen Wells being opinionated, I don't know, I kind of get an idea that a lot of people are just sort of going through the motions with some of these bands. The band that gets the biggest slating, The Mission, in December 1990, but I don't think The Mission really fit into the same sort of profile that we've been talking about. They seem to have been on some sort of mega tour and have gone to the Czechoslovakia.
Ah, I see, yes. Leading to the cover headline, Czech Pint.
Czech Pint Charlie's, Britain's stupidest band in Prague, is the is the brilliant headline.
Well, even that, because the mission the year before were the Christmas Melody Maker cover stars.
Wow.
Well, they're the cover stars in this one as well, but not exactly in a positive way.
This is very, very much the 1990 that no one likes to remember, perhaps.
No, exactly. It's whereas the Christmas cover stars, yeah, it was Sean Ryder. It was Sean Ryder and Bez with a huge spliff on the front of The Enemy, and on the front of the Melody Maker, it was also Sean Ryder, who was clearly a busy man that week.
I was reading Record Mirror at the time, and I'm sure he could easily find out what was on the cover of that week. But I don't know how well known it was at the time that, you know, they were not long for this world. So Record Mirror folded around April 91, I think. I remember being quite upset about this at the time and not really knowing, even noticing Enemy, you know, think, because they're being bigger, they were like not on the same kind of shelves as these smaller, glossier, more colourful looking music magazines that looked a lot more accessible to me at the time. And they just had a bit, they did have a bit more of a pro dance bias, I suppose, maybe a bit more variety on the covers. I think even Liza Minnelli was on the cover of Record Mirror at that time. But you weren't quite getting the same treatment or approach to music writing. The odd good interview, some good humor, you know, there's some overlap with like great pop things, comics, which went from one to the other. And a lot of good humor in these things, you know. So they...
I mean, I read Enemy religiously every week at the time. And I got to say that I think if I was to have a look at Sarah's old copies, it would mostly remind me that you know, 72 pages is an awful lot to fill every week with stuff about not very good bands or a lot of bands who are not very good, and some fairly desperate
do you know what,
desperate kind of copy and opinion.
I've remembered,
but there was also, you know, they introduced me to loads of good
stuff. I've remembered who was on the cover of Record Mirror's Christmas Issue, and it was Vic Reeves and Betty Boo.
Ah, Betty, actually, we should probably, before we finish, we should probably say something about Betty Boo, who are, probably has never been described this way before, but is the British jellyfish, in that she also got three nominations, much to the shock of people who weren't aware of what a big deal Betty Boo was. She was the great pop hope of that year.
Yeah, yeah. I noticed, kind of like, even with the KLF, a little bit of like, from maybe not just American, but Australia or anyone outside of Britain, like, you had to be there, that kind of, not necessarily that they think they're bad, but just that they don't really get why it's so revered, you know. And Betty Boo has a lot of residual affection in a similar way.
Well, I think she was the 1990 equivalent of Annie from Norway or Girls Aloud or something, in terms of, you know, not only were these people having bona fide, well, Annie wasn't having bona fide pop hits, but Girls Aloud were having bona fide pop hits, but also were very much liked by the tastemakers, the kind of people who were sort of slumming it in pop a bit and were like, oh no, but this is good. And that isn't always the way to get kind of well remembered, unfortunately. It can sort of, you know, not transfer quite as well after the fact, which is something we find a lot in the polls, in fact, when that kind of stuff, which has a very, very strong pop fan base, it doesn't necessarily
translate to something wider. Moved by Betty Boo or these days? Or
yeah, I didn't really know about, I mean, I, you know, I knew who she was because, like, my music fandom encompassed, like, me sitting on the floor of the record store in the mall and reading Billboard, and obviously they had the charts from all over the world, so that was mostly how I knew her. But I like what I've heard. It's very good. It's very, you know, solid early 90s stuff.
Yeah. It's very 1990.
Yeah.
In a way that some of the other acts
actually, yeah, one,
aren't. It's got
one of the discoveries for me. Listening, you know, going back to the highlights. Did anything? Was there anything you didn't really know at the time that you think, oh, that's actually really good? Is one of her album tracks called "Don't Know What to Do"?
Yeah.
And I thought, oh, because she's because you forget she would sing as well, so it's more of a sing. She's not really rapping. Yeah, there's probably a lot of revisionism going on. Like she wasn't like a massive artist who had number one, for example, here just has occupies a certain place, you know, British pop history perhaps, but was more versatile and, you know, probably could have done a lot more over longer than she did.
I mean, one of the things that really was noticeable doing the poll was the extent to which everything had rapping, and it really feels like it's the year where pop was, you know, maybe a little bit before and obviously for quite a while after as well, but it's the point at which pop is really trying to come to terms with hip-hop and trying to come to terms with, you know, what do we do with this stuff, what use can we make of it. So Vogue obviously has a rap section, Betty Boo is making pop records, but they're pop records based on her rapping.
Yeah, what about the one-upmanship of not just rapping but getting someone like Junior Reed to toast on your record, you know? Like,
Oh, I was just going to say, I was actually surprised that CNC Music Factory didn't get nominated.
Yes.
For anything.
Definitely.
Yeah.
It's Gonna Make You Sweat is a perfect example of that, right?
Yeah.
With the, you know, the Zelma Davis cosplaying Martha Wash hook line, and then Freedom Williams rapping, you know, and it was such a massive, massive song.
Yeah, wouldn't have been surprised to see it. Not, I think it... But here it's another one of those, a bit of a lag. It, late 1990, early 90s, but even so.
It was definitely a club, like a big club hit.
Yeah.
And it's funny because if you look at the club hits in the States from that year, like there is definitely a lot of overlap with pop. Like you have, you know, Vogue, The Power, All Around the World by Lisa Stansfield. But then you also have like Betty Boo, and this is just the number one songs. And, Everybody by Black Box.
Yeah.
But then like from December 1 on, the number one song is Gonna Make You Sweat in a dance club play.
Okay, we should wind it up here. But are there any kind of records or things that you want to say something about?
I want to just say that INXS put out a really amazing album that year. I think X or 10 or whatever you want to call it is a fantastic pop record, just top to bottom. And Suicide Blonde is a great single. Disappear is a great, like, just it was all hits. And I feel like they're a band that kind of, you know, the whole thing where after Michael Hutchence died, they went looking for the new lead singer on T here in the States and everything. I don't know if that damaged their legacy, but I feel like they kind of don't get talked about as much as they should.
Yeah.
Not just for 10, but for the other songs. And that was why I was so happy about that Dua Lipa record. That you know, interpolated Need You Tonight, because I was like, finally, somebody's, you know, giving them, and they were inescapable in pop. They were inescapable on MTV. They were inescapable on the radio. And it's just interesting to see like how they've faded away, because again, I think that, you know, they did quite fit the narrative. Like they weren't one of those bands that slotted easily into any of the splinters of rock that happened, you know, in the early 90s. So... But they were like 10 is a great. I mean, their concert tour on that record too was just fantastic, and I saw it. I know I saw it in 91, but they were not in 90. And yeah, I think that like it's interesting to, you know, go back and look at just the list of songs that were nominated, and then, you know, see what got knocked out, but see what just wasn't mentioned, like the Deadbeat Club by the B-52s, which is certainly a minor B-52s song, but it also, I think, it's a lovely showcase of Kay Pearson, Dee Wilson's harmony. And
the album, the B-52's album,
Cosmic.
Yeah, Game. It's from. I think the final track is like an instrumental. I can't remember what it's called, but I was, because I'm putting together, you know, lists of my favorite this and that, including instrumental, the 80s and 90s. I guess this would be 80s, really, but that was a nice thing to, you know, a bit of a nice surprise, you know, and makes me think I'm still trying to hear. Albums in full from that time, and there are deep cuts for a pop poll. It's, you know, you might think I'm not going to bother nominating something like by Talk or Cocteau Twins, Cocteau Twins did get in there, but I suppose there's that whole side of things. It's not necessarily a pop pop as most people interpret it, but you know, there's plenty more stuff for me to go back and hear for the first time, because it's on an album. And, you know, I was so obsessed with the chart, the singles chart, that I didn't get a look in for a long time after.
Well, Sarah, you nominated, actually. I should ask you about the tracks that you nominated, because you went further than the discussion's kind of gone and nominated. Were both your tracks in Japan?
Yeah, both of my tracks were Japanese songs that I know from doing Japanese language karaoke. So one song I found out about because a friend of a friend sang it, and it's called Imasugu Kiss Me by a band called Lindbergh, who are these amazing sort of power pop, sort of new wave-ish, really just energetic and like incredibly fun. Their whole album is just this really, really terrific set of kind of 3-minute style bangers. It's all of their albums are on Spotify, so definitely give them a go. They're all just called Lindbergh 1, 2, Lindbergh 3, and so on. but yeah, start with Lindbergh 1, why don't you? And the other song was Omatsuri Ninja by a band called Ninja, who are a boy band from the Johnny's Entertainment stable of boy bands. So as part of a very long tradition of young boys who are shirtless, and they probably shouldn't be, should all just wear cardigans some more. But this song is all about, just going to a festival and the general concept of ninjas. When I thought of it, I didn't think it was 1990 at all. It doesn't feel like it's part of the sort of 1990 pop club in a way that a lot of other commercial pop songs do. But I still thought it was a lot of fun, and I'm all up for getting a bit of non-English language pop in the mix, seeing how it goes.
Yeah, definitely.
Sort of what Maura was saying earlier about how 1990 is a very pre-global, you know, the pre-global internet, pre-sort of global music. Something that was interesting about the foreign language stuff in the poll was that none of it sounded like the 1990 that was happening in the UK and the US, and that was being quite exhaustively documented everywhere else. I think there was maybe like one sort of Spanish or one Brazilian track which sounded a little bit like it could have been sort of, you know, at the soft rock end of pop.
I guess the French song with the lady singer.
Yeah, the French song, and that did okay actually, but I mean even that I think could have, you know, that could have come at any time 5 years either side of 1990 in
it makes me wish I'd nominated
no one would have been
Enigma Sadness, just to have another non-English spoken record in here, even though it ended up being a massive year.
Number one in 1991.
It was released in a lot of places, but I think now I think you would find that gap would have narrowed. So I think if you were to do a poll from the noughties or the tens, the stuff that's being made around the world is less.
Yeah, I agree.
It's still very local, but it's less kind of local.
I mean, another thing about the Omatsuri Ninja as well is that it's talking about a very specific, you know, type of festival that happens in Japan. It you know, has the kind of call and response that a Japanese person will know. A non-Japanese listener might just think, why are they shouting washoi all the time? Like, what is that all about? So there's that sort of step away from it making a connection with the audience, and then, but also kind of musically, it's very all kind of, you know, syndromes and kind of a much earlier in the 80s, whereas Lindbergh sound more like they could just be coming out, similar new wave power pop, possibly with
And I think there was a sort of mystery to that. It's been very interesting hearing a lot of the stuff that was happening in the US, which I didn't really have much idea about, or only kind of got a very, very secondhand idea filtered through British perspectives in the music press and things. And I think that there's a sort of that kind of mystery is lacking a bit, just because the internet makes everything. It's a cliche to say, oh, it makes everything accessible. But it definitely kind of narrows the barriers and the difficulty to hearing.
But that's why I think like artists like, you know, for better or worse, The Weeknd and like H.E.R. and other, you know, acts that started out as like cloaked in mystery or like operating under pseudonyms, like that they've that they capture the imagination of so many people so well, because they do sort of resist that idea of being, I mean, even Beyonce, right, who is very, you know, even though she's like biggest star in the world, she's very deliberate and painstaking about the choices that she makes of presenting herself. And so there's a mystery in that. And certainly I, when I was in 1990, like, I forget if I started writing to this pen pal that I had in 90 or 91, but I remember we would trade tapes and she would send me stuff that was popular in Australia. And I was just so fascinated by all of it because it was so off the radar of anything that I knew about at all. And so, you know, I think that there was definitely that, like you said, internet gulf of mystery of like, what's going on here? Even like a couple of years later, like when I read about the Nirvana release Hormoning, which was like an Australian only like compilation of something, it's like, I really want this record. And that's, I guess that is a little gone now, although there are still like those albums that were taken off stream for whatever reason.
Yeah. Yeah. There's still stuff that it's hard to find. And there's still stuff obviously that you just don't know about. And it's that's kind of the barrier now, is knowledge rather than like knowing what to hear, what to go and look for. But that sense that there are these kind of parallel developments, I don't know exactly when it ends, but it ends at some point in the 90s, I think. The next poll's chronological, so or semi-chronological, so we'll be able to sort of maybe get some sense of that. Steve, Sarah, is there any record you want to shout out from 1990?
Definitely, well, silence.
I played it bad tactically. If I was one of those people who was like, I want my song to win the poll, it wasn't going to happen with Renegade Soundwave or Docker Jr. But I hope that you know, they caught some of it, whether it was for the first time or reminded someone.
The Docker Jr.
report that
the Docker Jr.'s video is amazing, really evocative.
I think there's a kind of dodgy upload of it on YouTube. This is the thing about 1990 as well. It's actually represented not as well as earlier years, and you know, maybe the 90s even as a decade. When you go on Spotify, you look for stuff and you can find more obscurities from the 80s and 70s than the 90s. So because of the catch-up, you know, approach people take, record companies themselves, I find that anyway, you know, I mean, we're probably never going to, it's never going to be easy to hear KLF on Spotify, you know. Yeah, YouTube is still a gold mine for a lot of this stuff. I was meaning to mention earlier as well that I would look on the Infinite Archive and see if they have the MTV Video Music Awards 19.
Oh my gosh, with Madonna's
video. I didn't get MTV we didn't get satellite TV until a few years later. But I think Channel 4 might have showed the Video Awards one year, and it's like this gateway to another dimension, because of the amount of you get to hear the kind of an audience response to things, you know, even when it's like the video number and it's stuff you've never heard of.
Can I close out by giving a slightly alternate canon, because I found this while I was researching. So this is Metal Edge was my enemy. They had their readers poll. So these are the top 8 songs of 1990 as voted on by Metal Edge readers. I don't think I voted them. I'm going to go from 8 to 1. So number 8 was Blaze of Glory by Jon Bon Jovi. Number seven was Don't Go Away Mad, Just Go Away by Motley Crue. One of the best bass lines that hard rock ever had, I think.
I don't know it, but...
Number 6, it's good. It's good. It's very breezy, but it's good. And it has a great
bass line. Humpty Dance.
Number 6
hair metal.
Was... no, but you're close, because it was Epic by Faith No More. It was number 6. Number 5 was Cherry Pie by Warrant. Number 4 was Unskinny Bop by Poison, the single that I was shamed when I bought it. Number 3 was Fly to the Angels by Slaughter, a ballad. Number 2 was Up All Night, also by Slaughter. And number 1, Something to Believe In by Poison.
Oh, I remember that. Slow jam.
Which, the messages of that song would probably be considered hard left in America right now, so... Take from that what you will.
Excellent. Okay, well, that is a great note to end on. Thank you so much, all three of you, Sarah, Steve, and Maura. I hope you've enjoyed the podcast. This is my improvised ending for the podcast. Next month, we will be talking about debut singles, taking you from a Wax Cylinder recorded in 1909 to a live performance that went up the week that the poll was announced. So... really, over a century of music to be brutally filleted and voted on. But that is next month. This has been 1990. By the time this podcast comes out, we will know what the top song of 1990, according to Twitter polls, was. It unfortunately isn't Something to Believe In by Poison, but in our hearts. Okay, thanks all. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.